The Guardian.
May of this year, Kenyan long-distance runner Eliud Kipchoge attempted to do what no human has done before. At a special event in Monza, Italy, he attempted to run a marathon in under 2 hours. On the day, Kipchoge ran nearly 3 minutes faster than the current world record held by fellow Kenyan Dennis Kimeto, and he missed his goal of a sub-2-hour marathon by just 26 seconds. But what can science tell us about the limits of human performance in long-distance running? How do marathons affect our bodies and minds? And with growing participation in amateur events, can just about anyone run a marathon?
So my first message, as I say, is don't panic. It's then to build up gradually. And the worst thing that you can do is find an old pair of training shoes in the bottom of your wardrobe that perhaps you haven't worn for 10 or 15 years, put them on and decide to go out and cover a long distance.
I know that I like to dedicate every 5K to somebody or something that's important to me. So my family or my boyfriend or my friends. Thinking about those throughout that time is really, really nice kind of thought.
The fastest man in the world, Usain Bolt, who can run 100 metres in around 9.6 seconds. If he were actually to run 100 metres and then continue running at that speed, disappear out of the stadium and return 26.2 miles later, having continued to run at the same speed, he'd have completed that 26.2 miles in 1 hour and 7 minutes.
He's done it again!
I'm Hannah Devlin. This is Science Weekly.
Slightly awkward because you probably won't be able to see it.
No, I know. That's all right. That's better. That's a bit...
To help investigate, I turn to a scientist who's been studying endurance sport for decades.
I'm John Brewer. I'm Professor of Applied Sport Science at St Mary's University in Twickenham.
John is also a keen runner. I sat down with him recently in the studio and started by asking him about his first marathon.
I will actually tell you about the very first one, which in many ways was a bit of a shock because I didn't finish it. And that was the second London Marathon in 1982. And I was a young, aspiring Loughborough student who was quite well trained at shorter distances, got extremely competitive, and to be perfectly honest, did everything wrong, from nutrition to pacing to excitement on the day. I got carried away and didn't finish the race. In fact, I finished in quite a bad state, ended up with something that I refer to in the book, which is hyperthermia, where I overheated. What I didn't know at the time, as well as I know now, is that, of course, when we run, you produce heat. The body has to produce energy in order to get from the start to the finish. That production of energy is accompanied by the production of heat. And unless you can lose that heat, the body temperature will rise. The way in which we maintain body heat is by sweating. And sweating, of course, loses fluid. And I found myself overheating, getting quite confused. And then the next thing I knew, I was waking up in St Thomas's Hospital. And I remember seeing the nurse with the London Marathon medal around her neck and said, "You must be tired. You've come off duty and run the marathon." She said, "No, the marathon was yesterday. You've been in a coma for 24 hours. And according to all the reports that unfortunately hit the newspapers afterwards, or even at the time, I was only given a 50-50 chance of pulling through. I have to say, I think part of that was that the medical support and the advice that we have today wasn't as good in those days. But nevertheless, that was a big wake-up call to me and indeed to my family that I'd done something that was very incorrect. And it was a bit like falling off a horse. It was one of these where you could either never do marathon running again or decide to find out what had happened, to get back on the horse and do it again. And that's what I did. I was very fortunate that when I came to the end of my undergraduate degree at Loughborough, I was offered the chance to do my research in endurance running. And that's what I did. And that helped me to understand far better what had gone wrong and to put it right. And I think, in a sense, whilst it was one of the most disappointing experiences of my life not to finish in 1982, it was probably in many ways one of the best things that ever happened to me, because it got me interested in the science of marathon running. And my first completion was then 2 years later in 1984. And I ran it in 1984, 85 and 86. And in a sense, that that exorcised the ghost of 1982 and enabled me to put science into good practice, to put everything that I'd learnt into good practice. I published my first paper on the science of marathon running in 1984 and in a sense haven't looked back since. And it's been great to put it all together into the Run Smart book.
What are some of the other physical stresses on your body when you're running 26.2 miles? I mean, it's the ultimate endurance sport, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the late Chris Brasher, who established the London Marathon, has called marathons the suburban man and woman's Everest. It's something that is a huge challenge, but at the same time, it is something that with the right training and preparation, you can adapt the body in order to cope with. You've mentioned the stresses. Well, just very simply, completing 26.2 miles, 42 kilometres, will require for most people around 30 or 40,000 strides, depending, of course, on your size and your stride length. When you run, each time your foot hits the ground, that's around 2 to 3 times your body weight that's impacting up through your feet and through the lower limbs. So the stresses are enormous, just from a physical perspective. At the same time, you have to have the right amount of energy in your body to cope with running 26.2 miles. It's equivalent roughly to about a day's energy intake for most people. So again, unless you have the energy there, you will run out of energy quite early on in the race. And we see that when people, as we call it, hit the wall, which is the common term that marathon runners use when those energy stores are exhausted. And I've mentioned already the dehydration factor. You have to lose sweat in order to keep cool. Scientific studies have shown that in even fairly normal conditions, you can lose up to 1 or 2 litres of fluid per hour. So again, unless you replace that fluid, the physical stresses will build up and the body will overheat. So it's a combination of things. And when you then build into that the mental demands of running a marathon, the people who cross the finish line have managed to accomplish a huge feat.
Simply crossing the finishing line of a marathon, regardless of your time, is a major achievement.
Limits how fast you go.
But I wanted to know what separates those runners who can complete a marathon in close to 2 hours and those who get closer to 5 or 6.
That's a really interesting exam question that we would probably set for our sports science students at St Mary's University, is what are the characteristics that differentiate the elite runners from the less elite runners. The first thing, whether you like it or not, is you have to have the right genetic characteristics to be an elite runner. So somebody who can run a marathon in, for example, around the world record time of just under 2 hours and 3 minutes will have to have the right genetic predisposition to be able to do that. And it's not something that the vast majority of the population would be capable of doing. You have to have an ability to transport large volumes of oxygen from the air that you breathe in into the muscles and convert that oxygen into energy using the fuel that the body has. You have to have the right physical capacity in terms of leg length, stride length, to be able to run at the right speeds. And you know, it's just worth thinking next time you're in the car that running a marathon in just over 2 hours is around 13.1 miles per hour. That's quite a significant speed to sustain for 2 hours. So the genetic characteristics, combined of course with the right training, the right application of science, the right blend of training, the long distance running, the shorter, higher intensity work, and of course the right nutrition, are critical to run a world marathon record time. But at the same time, running a marathon in 3, 4, 5 hours is also very physically demanding. That is still something that most of us are capable of, as opposed to not being capable of running a marathon in 2 hours. But again, it's a case of getting the training right, allowing the body to adapt steadily to the demands of training for a marathon and what a person will experience when they are running a marathon, which is all of the stresses and strains that go with running for 3, 4, 5 hours and covering that sort of distance. What is also interesting is the sort of question that we would ask our students is, what is the hardest? Is it harder to run a marathon in 2 hours or 4 or 5 hours? And I would sort of suggest that if it takes you 4 or 5 hours to run a marathon, that sometimes is a lot tougher than getting them over and done with in just over 2 hours. So mentally, certainly, the resilience that you need to keep running for 3, 4, 5 hours is in some ways as tough, if not tougher, than the mental resilience of having to run at a high intensity for 2 hours.
So for someone who is starting out for the first time in their first marathon, what would you say would be the first thing they should do if they're starting to train?
The first thing is don't panic. There will be a lot of people who perhaps have watched one of the big city marathons on television, perhaps had a couple of glasses of wine or pints of beer in the pub and gone home feeling very happy and thought, I will apply to do a marathon. I'm sure I can do it. And they throw their application in, forget all about it for 3 or 4 months whilst it's being processed. And then all of a sudden the email comes through or the letter lands on their letterbox floor to say, you're in the marathon. And there is that temptation to go, OMG, what's happened? What have I done? What have I let myself in for? So the first thing is not to panic. And I think part of the reason for saying that is that marathons have evolved enormously over the last 30 or 40 years. Now, if you go back to the 1960s and 70s, pretty much the only people running marathons were men. Marathons weren't, for all the wrong reasons, it opened up to women. It wasn't felt as if women were capable of doing them. Complete and utter nonsense, as we now know. And not only was it just men doing marathons in the 60s and 70s, it tended to be the sort of wizened people who had devoted their lives to their running. And to be perfectly honest, if you finished outside about 3 hours, then everybody would have packed up at the finish line and gone home and you'd be on your own. Today, of course, it's totally different. And we have a whole breadth of people from all walks of life taking part in big city marathons. And the cutoff time, for example, for the London Marathon is around 8 hours. So you can take that length of time, still cross the finish line, still get your medal and still receive all the plaudits and all the congratulations for doing so. So my first message, as I say, is don't panic. It's then to build up gradually. And the worst thing that you can do is find an old pair of training shoes in the bottom of your wardrobe that perhaps you haven't worn for 10 or 15 years, put them on and decide to go out and cover a long distance. You need to build up steadily and to gradually increase the mileage that you do, the intensity of training that you do. Gradually start to incorporate running into your lifestyle, and most importantly, focus on the weekly long run that you will do as part of your training. And one of the things that I say in the book is that that is probably the most important training session that you do every week. And building up that long run towards the sort of 15, 16, 17, 18, 20 mile, even 21, 22 mile point is absolutely essential, because physically and mentally that gets you into a state where you can run a marathon. And just to sort of try and put that into perspective, we often hear about the amount of mileage that a marathon runner does per week. I would sort of speculate that somebody who runs, say, 50 or 60 miles a week, but who does that through a whole series of, say, 8, 9, 10, 11 mile runs, is actually in a far worse position to run a marathon than somebody who does maybe 30 or 40 miles a week, but they've built up that single longest run to the 18, 19, 20 mile point. Because it's fair to say that whilst halfway in a marathon is actually 13.1 miles, the toughest part of the race is the last 7 or 8 miles. And unless you've got your body conditioned to getting into that zone, using an Everest analogy again, almost the death zone of marathon running, then you're going to find it much harder on the day. So it's building up that longest run gradually. And if you do that, and you time when you do it to a time of the week when you can fit it in with your life, it means you don't have to suddenly give up your lifestyle, never see your partner, your family again because you're out running. You can build marathon training into your weekly life with a few changes, of course, and still then accomplish a marathon very comfortably.
In recent decades, participation in long-distance running has soared, and in particular, far more women are now competing. With the gap between male and female marathon times narrowing, after this short break, I asked John where this trend might be heading.
And I'm afraid, and I don't in any way want to be accused of being sexist by saying this, genetically, men and women do differ.
We'll also hear from someone who competed in this year's New York Marathon, which took place at the weekend.
So yeah, really started to feel it then. I'd kept a pretty good pace up until about 27 kilometres, and I kind of had to slow down.
We'll be right back. Before we kick off again, I wanted to point you in the direction of another podcast here at The Guardian. It's called Brexit Means, and, as the name would suggest, attempts to finally find out what exactly Brexit does mean. Apart from, of course, Brexit. So if you feel like delving into the nitty-gritty of Britain's exit from the EU, make sure to join John Henley and his experts on The Guardian's Brexit Means. To find out more, head over to theguardian.com/podcasts or search Brexit Means on your favourite podcast app. Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Hannah Devlin. Before the break, we heard from John Brewer about his love of marathons, both on a personal and academic level. We also heard about the huge stresses that running 26.2 miles can place on our body. Importantly though, with the right training, John believes that most people would be able to complete this suburban Everest.
You're not interested.
We decided to speak to someone who, at the time of recording, was in the midst of training for the New York Marathon.
Hi, I'm Vicky Solly. I work for RAFA, which is a cycling clothing company. I've never done anything like this before. So.
It's all right.
Vicky sat down in the studio recently with producer Max.
So, obviously, you're currently training for this year's New York Marathon. Before we get into the specifics of your training, what are some of the sort of biggest physical and mental challenges when it comes to just the training for the marathon?
I think getting the miles in, like making sure that you're running that balance between running as much as you can and not getting injured. I've had some problems with injury over the past couple of years. So yeah, that real fine line of not going into injury, but still banking as many miles as possible. I think mentally, knowing that you have a big long run coming up at the weekends, kind of building yourself up for that and kind of psyching yourself up for, okay, I'm going to go out for 3 hours or however long. And then kind of the recovery after that, thinking, right, okay, I need to take a couple of days off before I start running again. And yeah, just kind of getting nervous as well. I mean, I really want to do a good job in New York. So trying to not get too worked up about it and knowing that if I get too nervous I probably won't do as well as I can do, so trying to make that balance definitely.
And then so something John Brewer talks about in his new book Run Smart is the importance of sort of building up the miles gradually. Is that something you do in your own approach, and maybe it'd be nice to get a sort of a bit more detail as to what your training regime is like when it comes to training for a marathon?
Kind of throughout the week, I'll do like a tempo session, so a bit more high intensity intervals, so running quickly for a shorter amount of time. I'll do two other just kind of base runs, just easy miles, and then a long run at the weekends. So I've been building up from 20k up to my longest run, which was 32k, so 20 miles. And then now I'm coming back down again. So I did that, my longest run, 3 weeks before the race. And so now I'm dropping down and then tapering. So you're nice and fresh for race day, hopefully.
Having previously run marathons in Paris and Amsterdam, Vicky's training regime has been fine-tuned over the past 2 years.
The start line and waiting.
But what about race day? How does that feel?
It's amazing. In Paris, we were stood on the Champs-Élysées and there were something like 30,000 people doing the race. So it was just full of people. Like everywhere you looked, there were people ready to go. And obviously you've got those nerves, you've got those butterflies, but that's kind of normal. And I think you need to thrive off that and kind of take that rather than get too worried about it. And I think you just got to have a bit of a plan in mind. I know for my first marathon, it was just about finishing. And then the one that I'm going to do in a week, I've got my pacing strategies in my head and I know kind of what I've got to set off kind of not too quickly and just try and get into a good rhythm. And yeah, like you just kind of, when you're stood on that start line, you're thinking about all the things that are ahead of you and like just thinking how amazing it will feel when you actually finish.
And then just sort of finally, when you're actually running the race, I mean, obviously this is something that I have no idea about, but when you're running the race, what are you thinking about?
Oh, lots of different things. I know that I like to dedicate every 5K to somebody or something that's important to me. So my family or my boyfriend or my friends, thinking about those throughout that time is really, really nice kind of thought. I think about my technique, especially when it's getting tough. So thinking about, you know, how I'm placing my feet on the floor, what am I doing with my arms, am I relaxed, that kind of thing. Yeah, and then you'll go into kind of survival mode at like 20 miles, you know, that you still got, you're nearly there, but you still got quite a way to go, and it will start hurting. Like, I know that, I'm not kidding myself. Trying to relax, trying to focus on your breathing, focus on anything that distracts you from kind of how much it's hurting. And yeah, and just kind of think that it will be all over soon.
And the $1 million question, what time is Vicky aiming for?
So my A goal is to run under 4 hours, but if everything goes perfectly, I'm hoping to get a good 4-H time for London Marathon, which is 3:45, but we'll see.
Lead vehicles start to roll. On your mark.
We'll hear from Vicky again a little later on to see how she got on at the weekend. Before that, though, I wanted to dig a little deeper into the elite side of marathon running. So, John, I wanted to ask about elite marathon runners and how much the world record has come down over the past decade. So when you ran your first marathon, I've looked it up and the time was 2 hours, 8 minutes. And today it's just under 2 hours, 3 minutes. How much has that drop been due to changes in our understanding of sports science?
It's hard to put an exact figure on it, but I think certainly sports science has made a significant contribution in terms of our understanding of the type of training that marathon runners need to do, the type of nutrition that a marathon runner should have, the type of on-course hydration that they can have, and the fluids and the food that they can have that will enhance their performance. I think there's also an element of the mental side of sports science, the psychology, making sure that the runner has the right approach. And if we look at the technical side, even footwear can have an impact. So I think it's a combination of things. And, you know, we use this term marginal gains in sport quite a lot these days. It's those small, almost fractions of a percentage difference that can be made or can be achieved by changing your diet, changing your running gait, changing your running shoe, that can all contribute to slowly taking the seconds, the minutes off a marathon running time. We have a world men's marathon record now of 2 hours, 2 minutes and 57 seconds, Dennis Kometo, the Kenyan. Incredibly fast. You know, that's around 4 minutes and 37 seconds per mile. So very fast speeds, and the sort of speeds that most people wouldn't be capable of running at for just 1 mile, let alone 26.2. The next barrier in sport, in a sense, is the 2-hour marathon. And there was, a manufactured attempt to break that 2-hour record by a shoe company fairly recently. I do think it will happen at some point. It will only be a matter of, pardon the pun, time before we see the 2-hour marathon barrier broken. It will require the right person, the right athlete, with the right genetic characteristics, on the right course, a course that is not too twisty, with turns or hills, with the right conditions. And again, scientific studies show that around 8, 9, 10 degrees Celsius is the optimum condition for marathon running, not too hot, not too cold. Clearly no wind to provide resistance. And I think if we see those factors coming together, then the 2-hour marathon barrier will be broken. But it is an incredibly fast time, and it may well take some time before that happens, because the rate of improvement in marathon running times will inevitably slow as it becomes harder and harder to shave those seconds and minutes off a marathon time. And bear in mind that in order to break the current male marathon record, somebody who runs it in under 2 hours will have to be almost a kilometer ahead, hypothetically, of the current world record holder. So it is quite a distance to pull out and to win by if you're going to get under the 2-hour mark.
And I'm interested in, as well, in women's marathon running, the times for that have come down. If you look, you know, taking it out a bit further over the past century, have come down even quicker than for men. And obviously women have been competing in the big marathons for a shorter period of time. Do you think that there's a day when a woman could beat a man at the world record?
Again, it's a very interesting question, and it's a nice exam question for students, because if you plot the improvement, the rate of improvement in the women's world marathon record against the rate of improvement from the men's marathon record, then you can actually see that the two lines cross, and the women's time would, in about 30, 40, 50 years, become quicker than the male time. In a sense, Hannah, you've just alluded to the reason for that, and that is that women have been running marathons for a shorter period of time than men, so the rate of improvement has been much more marked. And I'm afraid, and I don't in any way want to be accused of being sexist by saying this, genetically, men and women do differ. And because of the female physiology, which means that the ability to transport oxygen to the muscles in such a high rate that we see in men is lower in women, and because women have lower hemoglobin, which is the oxygen carrying component of the blood, and tend to have a lower muscle mass, I think it's very unlikely that we will ever see the world record for women breaking the world record for men, or being faster than the world record for men. But, and it's an important but, that's not to say that elite women cannot beat the vast majority of top male runners. It's just that when you move out to the very margins of elite performance and look at the very best man will almost certainly continue to always beat the very best woman. So I'm sorry for having to say that.
We started this episode by talking about the elusive two-hour barrier in marathon running. But assuming that runners break this at some point, do scientists have any idea where the ultimate limits of human performance might lie?
It's always a great question to ask and to try and debate. And I'll start with a slightly tongue-in-cheek answer to that. And if we look at the fastest man in the world, Usain Bolt, who can run 100 metres in around 9.6 seconds, if he were actually to run 100 metres and then continue running at that speed, disappear out of the stadium and return 26.2 miles later, having continued to run at the same speed, he'd have completed that 26.2 miles in 1 hour and 7 minutes. So completely hypothetical, but it just gives you an idea of the kind of human pace that the body can reach, and if it could sustain that pace, what time you would compete a marathon in. We know a marathon will never be run in 1 hour and 7 minutes, but physiologically and anatomically, in a sense, that's the absolute lower limit. In reality, probably around the 1 hour 50 mark is something that I think we might get close to in perhaps hundreds of years to come. It depends on physiology, on sports science, the right conditions, and of course our understanding of training and having the right individual in the right environment. And you never know what type of individual might suddenly appear on the marathon running scene. In a sense, I mentioned Usain Bolt, quite a unique person, a one-off who I'm sure will have the world record for many, many years to come. If we get the marathon running equivalent of Usain Bolt, who knows what time we might see. And I think it's also worth bearing in mind that the one thing with marathon running, of course, is that if, as we do, we measure it in seconds and tenths and even hundredths of seconds, there is always a chance to shave just a very small amount off the marathon time. So I think we'll see the marathon world record at both men's and women's level continue to be broken for many, many years to come. It's just that it might be seconds that we see taken off rather than any larger chunks. So small marginal improvements, which will gradually bring the time down. I think it's highly unlikely that we'll see it get much below around 150 though.
Bringing things back to the present day, we caught up with Vicky, who had been hoping to run the New York Marathon in under 4 hours.
Hello.
Hi, Victoria. It's Max here.
Producer Max gave her a call.
Oh, hiya.
How are you doing?
He asked her how it went.
Really started to feel it then. I'd kept a pretty good pace up until about 27 kilometres, and I kind of had to slow down because I couldn't keep up the pace that I was running. I had some pain in my legs, and that was quite difficult.
And if she managed to finish it?
Even at 200 metres to go, you couldn't see the finish. Then you come around this little last corner, and then you could see it, and it was... Oh, it was brilliant. I managed to find like a GB flag on the floor. So I like picked that up and managed to run across the finish line with my flag, which was really cool. So yeah, it was tough. It was really tough. It was much hillier than I thought it was going to be. And just kind of like really hard work, but it was amazing. Like the crowds were incredible. As everybody says, the atmosphere was insane, even though it was a drizzly kind of wet day, but there was still loads and loads of people out, so yeah, it was amazing.
And then, so final question, Victoria, when we spoke before, you said you know, you'd be happy to do it under 4 hours, potentially 3:45. What kind of time are we talking?
So I did it in 3 hours and 56 minutes and 21 seconds.
That's amazing.
I missed like my AAA perfect goal, but I couldn't have given it any more. And my previous marathon time was 4 hours and 12. So I took 16 minutes off my PB, which I've got to be happy with. And yeah, to get into the 4 hour mark was kind of the main goal. And I didn't walk at all, which was really good. So
that's brilliant. That's fantastic. I suppose now it means you're just going to have to do another one and try for that 3:45 mark, right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think not next year, but probably the year after.
Special thanks this week to John Brewer and Vicky Solly. And congratulations to Vicky on completing the New York Marathon. If you want to find out more, we'll include a link to John's latest book, Run Smart, in the episode's description on the Guardian website. If you've got any questions, queries, or feedback, please get in touch via our email address, scienceweekly@theguardian.com. I'm Hannah Devlin. This is Science Weekly.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.